Hello and welcome. Suzanne McGee's sweepingly detailed account on the morphing of Wall Street's investment banks from the 60s to the noughties should be required reading for bankers, traders, regulators, and public officials, nearly all of whom have failed to grasp, at least publicly, the sea change that has occurred in how the street conducts its business and how that business transformed from one of an agency relationship serving customers to that of a principal one serving itself. Or as Suzanne says on page 5, from a quasi-utility to a self-serving, risk-taking, profit-maximizing behemoth. Suzanne's strength as a financial writer has always been her wonderful ability to take extremely complex subject matter, and in the eyes of many, esoteric and incomprehensible, and create stories nearly all cannot just understand, but be refreshingly educated by. I know I've had the pleasure of being educated by her for nearly 15 years. Suzanne is a contributing editor for Barron's and has written about the financial markets for the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Institutional Investor, and the New York Post. Thanks for joining us today, Suzanne.
Thanks for your interest.
First, let me say that the book is terrific and it would take an interview of at least several hours to do it justice. Therefore, listeners, do yourself a favor if this is a topic that interests you and get the book. I identified nearly 50 subtopics in the book that are vital to a thorough understanding of the topic. The title is Chasing Goldman Sachs, How the Masters of the Universe Melted Wall Street Down, and Why They'll Take Us to the Brink Again. Suzanne, what does Chasing Goldman Sachs refer to?
The title came about as I started thinking about what the central problem that produced the meltdown really was. On the surface, obviously, as we all now will know and understand, there were problems with lax lending standards, with people treating their homes as ATM machines, with excessive risk-taking pretty much across the board from consumers like you and I, all the way up to the top of the financial system and the giant investment banks, using leverage and taking extraordinary amounts of risk. But underneath all that lies something else. It's a way that Wall Street began to think about its own business, that the firms like Merrill Lynch, like Morgan Stanley, began to think that they weren't really just in the business of assisting their clients in what I describe as a financial utility. They weren't just there to help money flow more smoothly and efficiently from those that possessed it and were looking for a great investment idea to those who needed fresh capital for their idea or business. Rather, they were looking for ways to enrich themselves. Their role had fundamentally altered. And in a nutshell, the title Chasing Goldman Sachs refers to the tendency of these firms to look around over their shoulders, see what others were up to, look at who was being most successful in terms of raking in the most business and the largest profits, and try and emulate them, if possible, outdo them. And of course, their quest to do just that was ultimately what brought about their downfall.
Right. And on page 306, you say that the ethos of Chasing Goldman Sachs, pursuing the maximum level of profits and return on equity without heed to systemic risk or the interests of all the stakeholders in the money grid, is a model that has to be left behind as part of the wreckage of the old Wall Street. Before we dig more deeply into this topic, I think it's important for our listeners to wrap their minds around the current form that Wall Street occupies. So we need to cover some necessary events and terms. After the 1929 stock market crash and during the Great Depression, public officials passed laws and created agencies in the hopes that a share decline of similar magnitude would be prevented and the financial markets would exist to serve companies and the public in much the same way as you state an electric or water company serves its customers as a utility. Perhaps the linchpin of financial consumer protection laws was something called the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. What was Glass-Steagall, Suzanne?
Glass-Steagall mandated the separation of investment banking activities, the kinds of things that a firm like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley did, i.e. helping companies raise capital, facilitating trading, and so on, from the kinds of activities that the big commercial banks were doing, the lending institutions like J.P. Morgan or the firm that became known as Citigroup or Chase Manhattan Chemical Bank. Some of these names have have, of course, vanished from our world today. Back in the 1930s, all of these activities were being undertaken by the same institution, and the feeling was that one was essentially far more risky, investment banking was far more risky, or liable to lead to far more risk-taking by its practitioners than the relatively mundane and less profitable but higher throughput business of commercial lending, and that to ensure the stability of the institutions, the two should be separated. Now, of course, to Wall Street, over time, Glass-Steagall became more of a target than something that was seen as a stabilizing force, and the game began how to outwit it and ultimately knock it down. A great many lawyers and a great many investment bankers did their very best for decades and with greater effort beginning in the 1980s than ever before, and ultimately succeeded at the end of the 20th century in the effective repeal of Glass-Steagall and an entirely new era where giant financial institutions could once again have a great impact in our day-to-day lives via lending and also take tremendous risks.
So Glass-Steagall was in place from 1933 until I think it was 1999 when it was repealed, as you say. It certainly did do something to protect the financial markets, I guess, from themselves and, of course, from us. But back in the 1960s, Wall Street, I guess, was beginning to be noticed by pension funds, other investment funds, mutual funds, the individual investor, and they couldn't keep up with the actual paper trail. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I take my analysis of what went wrong on Wall Street all the way back to the 1960s and 1970s. Maybe it's because I'm a bit of a history buff myself. I tend to look past the self-evident immediate causes to root causes that may lie further back in time. And while they're often overlooked because they occurred so long ago, they can also end up explaining far more of what actually happened. And in the case of what happened on Wall Street, those causes, you have to dig all the way back to the 60s and 70s, because it was events then that really transformed the way investment banking and banking were practiced and laid the groundwork for a lot of the changes that happened. For starters, you did, as you mentioned, have the virtually complete collapse of the ability to process trades, where investor interest in the financial market outstripped firms' abilities to process the trades, to keep up with the paperwork. This was just as computers were becoming possible for investment banks to introduce and to use. And the idea was, yes, we might be able to introduce these, but we can't do it overnight. And meanwhile, the stock exchange ended up closing the equivalent of a day and a half a week just to give people time to catch up with the trades that were done the other 3.5 days.
Amazing.
But that wasn't the only cause. It led to others, and I argue more sweeping ones, such as the interest in the part of investment banks and going public. Now, for all of their history, these had not been publicly traded corporations, but rather private partnerships. Indeed, you couldn't be a member of the New York Stock Exchange, the Wall Street Insiders Club, if you were a publicly traded company. And that was fine insofar as it went. But again, by the 1960s, early 1970s, there was a lot of restlessness on the part of these private partnerships, because every time a partner retired, the remaining partners had to buy back his capital at the prevailing value. So there was never a stable base of capital, and there was never a way to ensure there was enough capital, especially when it came around to making very large scale investments in new technology like computers. So there came one day when the folks from Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette, later acquired by Credit Suisse, walked into a meeting at the New York Stock Exchange and informed their peers that they had just filed to go public. And Felix Rohatyn, the eminent banker, was utterly outraged, according to people who were there, and he wasn't alone. This was the end of an era, and I think correctly, in the eyes of many of the people at the time, were dismissed as being stodgy and old-fashioned. It was the end of an era that had helped to control the way Wall Street looked at risk. After all, when you're part of a partnership, you have a very clear vested interest in making sure none of your partners venture too far off the ranch. Your capital, your retirement savings are all tied up in the firm. You're not banking a bonus. You're increasing the value of your partnership. You can't just turn your back and walk away if things go up in smoke. So if you're a bit worried about what Joe down the hall is doing in his real estate banking group, or Mike over there is thinking about this newfangled stuff called software, you made pretty sure that you were comfortable with the risks they were taking before you gave them your go-ahead. And your go-ahead was necessary. You weren't just an employee, you were an owner. And then after this wave of IPOs, that ethos gradually changed, as many of the long-term bankers on the street told me. That kind of discipline gradually eroded, and it became more important to deliver big levels of returns to shareholders.
Was it a direct result of the back office collapsing that really caught Wall Street flat-footed, didn't it?
It did. That was certainly one of the contributing factors that made having a larger and more stable capital base urgent. It's hard to point to one cause and say, without that, this would never have happened. But certainly, as I mentioned in the book, that was one of them. The other was simply the kinds of business opportunities that were open to the firms at this time. Finance was going global. That required setting up offices in London and later on still in places like Tokyo. Those weren't cheap to do on the traditional model. And these institutions, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, etc., found themselves competing for business with large banks in Europe that were not subject to the limitations of Glass-Steagall, that could, for instance, put their capital on the line and commit capital to trades and to underwriting. And unless and until the partnerships had a base of capital and could do the same, they were never going to be able to compete as effectively. At least that was their conviction.
Right. So DLJ going public, that also put pressure on the other investment banks to go public also, didn't it?
In fact, the folks at Merrill Lynch were rather annoyed because they'd hoped to be the first out the gate. As it turned out, they followed very rapidly. And the first wave of IPOs and investment banks continued right through the 70s and into the 1980s. The process wasn't really complete, of course, until Goldman Sachs finally completed their much discussed and much delayed IPO at the end of the 20th century, roughly about the same time that Glass-Steagall collapsed.
Right. And that was, I think that was just about, what, 13% of the firm?
Roughly at that time. And it was followed up with subsequent offerings that further diluted ownership, yes.
Okay.
Over the following decade.
Traditional partnership model that had existed since, I guess, the founding of the New York Stock Exchange under the Buttonwood Tree in 1792. That all changed with DLJ's IPO, which happened, I guess, in 1970, and the other investment banks had to follow. And of course, that applied pressures to the banks to really pay more attention to their shareholders than to the traditional function that they had served in the past, that of an intermediary. Is that right?
Exactly. Now, don't get me wrong. Bankers, as we saw in the 1930s, you know, were never really Robin Hood's crusading for the rights of the poor and downtrodden. These were folks who were always out for their self-interest. The question was there something on the other side pushing them to be prudent? Was there someone muttering in their ear, look, you better be careful or you're going to blow yourself to kingdom come? In the same way that triumphing ancient Roman general riding through the streets and being acclaimed by the crowd actually had a slave perched behind him on the chariot to whisper in his ear, remember, you are also mortal, you're going to die.
Right.
To prevent hubris from building up. The transition from partnership to publicly traded, I would argue, is one of the most significant factors that removed that sort of inner check system. Certainly in the eyes of people who lived through that era, if you push them and you ask them to think back deeply, when did the zeitgeist change on Wall Street? They will ultimately take it back to the change in the way their businesses operated. They'll take it back to, well, after the IPO, things started to change. At Goldman Sachs, you see it more clearly, perhaps, because their IPO is more recent. So when I talk to some Goldman Sachs bankers who are some former partners who'd since left the firm, I would ask them and they'd say, look, in the 1980s and into the early 1990s, there were things we just would not do. There were some clients decided as a firm we didn't want to work with because we saw it as too risky and not worth the profit we would be booking. There were types of business that we didn't think were conducive to our long-term reputation that we didn't need to be doing. And we would always ask ourselves, they told me, do I need to do this deal? What is the motivation? And almost unanimously, some of the former Goldman people, while they still love and respect their firm, certainly far more than the average American does today, they were not happy with all of the post-IPO changes. And that was the biggest one. When the Abacus transaction hit the headlines in 2010, they saw this as the biggest example of that. You know, we did not stop to ask ourselves, at what price are we doing this business? And is the revenue that we're going to get from it in the short term worth all the aggravation and headaches and potential losses that we get down the road?
Right. And what was Abacus for our listeners?
Abacus was the mortgage-backed securities transaction that became the center of the SEC's lawsuit against Goldman Sachs. The suit was filed in April of 2010 and ultimately resolved this past summer of 2010. And essentially, the SEC alleged that Goldman Sachs had failed to disclose material facts, that the person taking the other side, i.e. betting that the pool of mortgage securities involved in the transaction would decline in value, helped to participate in picking those securities, and that that fact was material and not disclosed to the German bank that took the other side of the trade.
Right. So Glass-Steagall, 1933, seemed to hold the system together fine. The back office collapse in the late 60s was one of the contributing factors to the private partnerships that were the investment banks going public. And then in May Day, 1975, something came along called May Day. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, May Day, you know, for some people, they think of it as the day that organized labor celebrates their rights. For others, May Day is a distress signal. On Wall Street, May Day was shorthand for deregulated commissions. Up until that point, a system of fixed commissions had been in place on the street, and they were, you know, fairly high, you know, a couple of dollars a trade, depending on the size of the transaction. There was a certain price fixed for a board lot of 100 shares, and all the firms charged the same rate. But as more and more people became interested in the financial markets, as there became more involvement, whether by households or mutual funds or pension funds, as equity markets began their transformation into the system that prevails today, one where, you know, we all follow what the Dow is and what the S&P is, and we know to refer to them by those shorthand monikers. Our grandparents certainly wouldn't, and this was the period in which our parents became active investors. But in the eyes of the people who regulated Wall Street, an impediment to the growth of investment banking and the growth of investing generally were these fixed commissions. If you were going to pay that much in commission, you'd think twice, three times before deciding to buy or sell, and you might even walk away when you really didn't want to. So they looked at this and said, look, it's a level of commission that made sense when people were dealing in relatively small amounts and they were just buying and holding. Makes sense, perhaps. But now we've got far higher volumes. There were people on the street who could make a fortune in a month. There are traders I talked to for this story who said, look, I accumulated all of my wealth in the years running up to May Day because I was just being paid so well just for executing a transaction.
Wow.
And the SEC probably very correctly said, why should they be making money for essentially getting out of bed and going to the office in the morning? Shouldn't they have to do something a little harder to earn all that? As with many things in life, May Day brought with it unintended consequences. No one was thinking 20, 30 years down the road, but what happened immediately was that the commission revenue collapsed. This is one rare time where Goldman Sachs got it wrong. They thought it would sort of slip off gradually over time, and in fact, their commission revenue fell in half overnight, literally. And the investment banks have looked around at each other, the partners looked at each other and said, oh my God, what do we do now? How do we replace this revenue? And there was no easy answer. They turned to some of these new global markets, and then they started innovating. They started trying to come up with new products, proprietary products, things that they could legitimately charge their clients a higher margin on. The problem with that was that the intellectual property rights over a new Wall Street product, whether it's an option or an exchange-traded fund, doesn't last that long. People look around, see it's a success, and they copy it and produce their own version. Even the greatest new idea could help make you money only for perhaps a year, maybe even 6 months. Look at Drexel, Burnham, Lambert, when Mike Milken pushed the concept of the high-yield or junk bond from something tremendously obscure to something mainstream. Every other firm on Wall Street rapidly copied him. He just kept doing it better, but he had to take a great deal more risk to maintain his firm's preeminent position in that market. And that was a conundrum that every Wall Street institution faced. At some point, if you're going to remain the first, if you're going to keep using new products to coin money, you have to do one of two things, or both. You have to keep lowering your quality standards so you're willing to deal with pretty much anybody, and you had to add leverage. So this was the trade-off. If my shareholders are demanding that I make more money for them and I'm relying on this 6-month-old, year-old product to do it, I'm going to have to cut corners. And, to fast forward, that is pretty much what happened with the mortgage-backed securities market.
Now, after May Day, which was 1975, I believe it was in 1979, IBM, International Business Machines, selected a firm other than the one they had a relationship with to do business with, didn't they? And that was something that wasn't done on Wall Street. Is that right?
Well, they had a long-term relationship with one firm, Morgan Stanley. And at that point, the client-banker relationships were so close and so long-standing that Institutional Investor magazine even published an annual list of who banks whom. But by now, the clients were looking around and saying, wait a second, why don't we get these guys to compete for our business? And IBM, with its power in the market, was one of the first to move. And they told Morgan Stanley, not so much that they didn't want Morgan Stanley on a deal, but they wanted them to share the spotlight with Salomon Brothers, which was emerging as a real bond powerhouse. And Morgan Stanley put their foot down and said no. And IBM's executives said, okay, too bad. It's been lovely working with you, but we're going to give this deal in its entirety to Salomon Brothers then, which is precisely what they did. And in fact, it took several more years before Morgan Stanley would agree to share the lead underwriting role on any kind of transactions. They were a little slow to pick up on that changing relationship. So clients contributed to what happened on Wall Street, to the changes that ultimately ended up destabilizing the street for them and for other users. They, again, failed to think about the long term, the unintended consequences. Yes, by being tremendously loyal and not pitting one investment bank off against another, they maybe ended up paying higher fees. But by forcing them to compete against one another, they also pressed them to take on more and more risk. And that ultimately destabilized the entire system.
It's amazing that prior to that time, prior to 1979, that Wall Street had that kind of relationship with these public companies that they didn't dare or they had no desire to go pit one company against the other. It's an amazing part of Wall Street.
Well, it came about in a perfectly logical way because they looked around for the best firms. They wanted to forge long-term relationships, and the kind of long-term relationships where the banker that they were working with wouldn't think of acting in a way that was outside of the client's interests. Yes, they were obviously monitored those relationships very carefully to make sure that they weren't being taken advantage of, but in a different way from the internal workings of the partnership investment banks, they viewed themselves as being partners in a kind of way with their bankers, that the bankers were acting in the client's interest as well as their own. And eventually what happened with the rise of very professional, very knowledgeable financial people within the ranks of companies like IBM, they began to question that and say, look, they're not our partners. We're their client. They're here to say how high when we say jump. We have enough know-how to judge who's best to underwrite a specific deal, unless was born the concept of the bake-off, where the investment firms had to strut their stuff and compete on every transaction.
Right. This isn't your grandfather's stock market, right?
It's not even your father's stock market.
Right. So after IBM took that step, and throughout the whole decade of the 70s, baby boomers were beginning to buy homes. And what happened with that, the demand for homes?
There's always been this particular relationship between an American and his home. Home ownership is almost a holy grail politically, and it was certainly in the interest of American politicians to encourage high levels of home ownership, higher than had existed historically in this country, higher than had existed other places. They viewed that as a way of getting their electorate comfortable with the entire political system, a cynic would say, perhaps making them complacent and not likely to rock the boat. So there was introduction of policies like the mortgage interest deductibility and all the things that American home buyers have learned to love and cherish, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, all kinds of institutions and policies that made it easier and easier to buy homes and more desirable to do so. And before long, the mortgage market was probably the single biggest market in dollar terms of all the financial markets. And then came along several bright people, among whom was Lou Ranieri, a firm that was then known as Salomon Brothers, who said, wait a second, we can find a way to make these mortgages and, for that matter, other kinds of loans investable. We can pool them together, and then we can cut them into slices and sell interest in them. And a process became known as securitization. And like all great ideas, this one made a tremendous amount of sense on Wall Street, even though it was one of the root causes of the 2008 market collapse. It was very well received at the time, and it took probably 20, 25 years for it to start to go terribly wrong, as it did in the noughties, the first decade of the 21st century.
Right.
Again, it was over time, as more and more people jumped into this market, the lenders and the people who bought and structured these pools of mortgage securities, which came to be known as CDOs, or collateralized debt obligations, ended up lowering their standards to keep their product creation machines humming along and the profits coming in the door.
Right, but it had its roots in the 1970s, right?
And even before then. It has its roots in the American belief that home ownership is an absolute good.
Those who row the boat generally don't have time to rock it.
Exactly.
Right.
The more you feel you have a stake in the system, the less you are likely to challenge it.
Exactly. Now, you mentioned before the computer, that had a big impact on how Wall Street became what it is today. And of course, models such as Black-Scholes. Just touch briefly on what Black-Scholes is, please.
Black-Scholes is named after the two academics who came up with a way to value options over time and thus made possible the creation of the whole derivatives industry. It's basically a way of measuring volatility. So, for instance, if I buy an option on Microsoft stock today, the return that I get is going to depend on what happens, not just to the stock, but to the pattern of behavior of the stock and the amount of time that elapses before my option expires. So they came up with a model that takes into account that volatility and made it possible for computers to track with tremendous precision and estimate the real value of an option over time, and thus made it possible to trade options as a market that's at least as active, sometimes more active, than that of the stocks themselves.
Sure, exactly. Thank you. In the 90s, a company called Netscape went public, and that had a big impact on Wall Street. Can you explain to our listeners how that was?
Well, to a lot of people on Wall Street, Netscape was the real sign that Wall Street had shifted from being a kind of utility or a utility-like entity to one that was really a casino. As one of the bankers who was involved in the underwriting said it, you know, I thought to myself at the time, my gosh, our raison d'etre here isn't to be a prudent gatekeeper anymore. It's just to encourage investors to behave like gamblers at a casino, to go in, to throw their money on the table and say, I'll take, you know, red 21.
Right.
Because Netscape was really the first business about which there was a tremendous amount of buzz, a tremendous amount of excitement that couldn't point to any profits, that hadn't been in business that long. Its future was very murky in a business that itself was still very, very, very new, the internet. And the underwriters took the attitude when some of their underlings sort of voiced concern about this change in their MO and said, look, if we don't do this deal, one of the firms down the street is going to grab it and pocket the fees. So what do you want? And this became a constant refrain around Wall Street. We have to do it because if we don't, somebody else will. And caveat emptor. It's up to the investor to look out for himself and to manage the risk himself. It's not our job to do it for them.
Right, exactly. And of course, I think that is at the heart of what led to this recent collapse, because Goldman Sachs or whoever the firm was going to be, the other firms weren't just going to allow them to go and make money off of these CDOs and these other derivatives, because if they did, well, number one, the market would not collapse the way it did because there just wouldn't be that much activity. But number two, if they did, their shareholders would say, you're out and somebody else is in, or we're taking our money to Goldman Sachs, right?
Ironically, that's exactly what happened to Morgan Stanley, one of the firms that was involved in leading the IPO of Netscape. That Phil Purcell was ousted for precisely that reason. Now, you know, Purcell may not be a person who would win Most Likable Investment Banker of the Year awards, but he did have an ethos on Wall Street that was rapidly becoming unfashionable, and that was we shouldn't commit too much of our own capital to transactions. We shouldn't become principals in transactions, i.e., behaving as if we're a hedge fund. There are some business lines that we should not be in, however profitable. And he was ousted in what essentially was a coup d'etat by a group of shareholders who disagreed with that and said, no, your role as a CEO, you have a fiduciary duty to maximize profitability. And we believe that doing what the other investment banks are doing is in our interests. So goodbye, Mr. Purcell. And
right.
other CEOs and other bankers sat up and took notice, and they became less and less likely to challenge what their large shareholders wanted from them. If someone came into the, one of the shareholders representatives came into the office of Stan O'Neill at Merrill Lynch or whoever it might be and said, look, why aren't you earning the same return on equity that Goldman is earning? The defense couldn't be, well, we're a different kind of firm. The only legitimate defense was, we're trying to do just that. We're trying to out-earn Goldman's ROE. Because to those investors, you know, why stick around, settle for a smaller return on equity from Merrill Lynch if you could invest in Goldman Sachs that would generate far higher profits for you, and those higher profit levels would then be reflected in a higher stock price.
Right, exactly. So Phil Purcell, unfortunately for him, and I think this was in 2004 when he was ousted, right?
Yes.
Phil Purcell found out that there is career risk in not taking enough risk.
Precisely, and that career risk was not limited to someone in the CEO suite. I talked to another banker at a very large firm that shall go unnamed, as indeed it is in the book, and you know, his team worked on financing leveraged buyouts in which a group of financiers plonks down a down payment in the same way that you or I would do that to buy a house and then borrows the rest of the purchase price of a business. And this particular buyout firm was going to do an extremely large transaction with an extremely small down payment. And my source was one of the people assigned to find buyers for the loans and the bonds that would finance the rest of the transaction. And he went to his boss and said, look, I'm not sure about this. I'm concerned this is a different kind of transaction. It's higher risk. It's maybe not such a great deal for some of our investors. And his boss looked at him and said, are you telling me you can't sell these? And my source said, no, that's not what I'm saying. And his boss interrupted him and said, if we don't do this transaction, again, this refrain that came to be heard up and down Wall Street, if we don't do this transaction, somebody else is going to. So just get on the phone and sell it. And he never again raised a question about the wisdom of a deal because he knew it would be a career ender.
So they're all chasing Goldman Sachs for the reasons that we've been discussing. But it wasn't just that Goldman had such a great return on equity, or ROE, as you explain in the book, because they were Goldman Sachs. They had a great ROE because they were a strategic thinking firm. Isn't that right?
Precisely. I mean, Goldman, as I said earlier, picked and chose its business areas. They decided there's no margin for us to be in the business of advising the hostile raiders of the 1980s because it's going to annoy the hell out of our long-term clients who trust us to advise them. Why should they confide in us if they think we're going to turn on them and use our inside knowledge, our in-depth knowledge of their business in ways that are against their interests? So they said, we're not going to do that. They did not follow the pack in the height of the dot-com boom and buy a retail brokerage, thinking that the internet era was transforming investing in long-term ways and that they had to be a part of that. Instead, they looked at that and said, we don't need a retail brokerage. That's not a business that we know. We've been an institutional firm working with pension funds, with mutual funds, with other professional investors. We don't know how individual investors behave. We don't know how to manage the risks associated with that business, and we're not going to go there. And sure enough, some of the people who made that move ended up either regretting it bitterly or having to spend months and years readjusting their business when the internet bubble burst. And Morgan Stanley, which was at the time Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter, was one of those. And then, of course, later when Merrill Lynch went out and bought its very own mortgage lending businesses, so it had access to a steady stream of mortgages for its CDO creation machine, Goldman said no. Again, you know, we don't know the mortgage lending business. We're not going to go there. Sure, we'll help structure those products, but we'll buy them on the open market. We'll establish relationships with lenders and we'll acquire them that way. We don't want to have to manage the risks associated with a business that we don't know inside and out. The long-term consequences of that may not be good ones. And I suspect a lot of bankers at UBS, at Merrill, at Citigroup wish they had the same kind of wisdom along the way that Goldman did. Obviously, the ultimate example of their strategic thinking and, for that matter, their risk management, which I argue the other way that they became the envy of Wall Street, was in late 2006 when the folks there, led by David Vinier, who's now their chief financial officer, sat down and said, this real estate bubble is about to go pop and we need to be prepared for that to happen. And they began to, even while they continued to satisfy their clients in terms of anyone came to them and said they were interested in structuring a CDO transaction, they would look for someone like the German bank that was on the wrong side in the IKB deal. They would look for someone who was bearish and set up that deal. They might have rolled their eyes and shrugged their shoulders at the foolishness of some investors, but they weren't going to turn away business. On the other hand, they weren't going to actively work to get themselves into that business more deeply.
Right. And of course, as you say on page 375, Wall Street doesn't discourage strategic planning. It just doesn't reward it. It's all about the year or the quarter.
Exactly. I did talk to someone at another firm who made a move later in life into Wall Street, and strategic planning was the thing that he tried to introduce into his firm's thinking, and he basically gave it up as a bad job.
Right. And of course, you compared it to so perfectly poker versus chess. So Goldman, they seem to be, at least prior to this latest disaster, the only chess players on the street where all the other banks are playing poker.
Pretty much. And not just playing poker, but trying to, you know, hire people to go and peer behind Goldman's hand over their shoulders and report back. So UBS was one firm that consciously set out, they hired a consulting firm to go and see, you know, what can we do to increase our return on equity? And the management consultants came back and said, you need to take more risk. You need to get into this business. You need to get into that business more aggressively. You need to compete. You need to put more capital at risk. Pretty much all the things that banks later found cost them billions of dollars. But the consensus was, we need to do that if we're ever going to catch up with Goldman. And over at Citigroup, where Bob Rubin was hanging his hat, a former Goldman Sachs banker who, after his stint at the Treasury Department, returned to Wall Street, but at another firm, someone came back to him and said, well, we need to emulate Goldman Sachs. And Rubin sort of looked at him and said, well, you know, if we're going to do that, we have to manage risk and we don't have the systems or the people to do it. And he said, we can't be Goldman Sachs. But of course, that didn't stop the firm from trying its best to just chase them.
Getting back to Goldman Sachs strategic thinking, there were a lot of changes taking place in Wall Street in the 80s. And in 1991, as you say on page 124, Goldman opened what would become the first in a series of private equity funds. What exactly are they, Suzanne, private equity funds?
Well, private equity funds are, in their pure form, are just partnerships of individuals who I described earlier will band together, invest in a company with a small down payment and a lot of borrowed capital, and then turn around and sell it for a profit down the road after making some changes to the way the business works. So they might buy a company that had management challenges or where the business focus had become blurred, in some way a distressed company, not necessarily in financial distress, but whose strategic vision might not be clear, but where they thought they could, with new management, a new strategy, some other initiative, dramatically increase its value in a relatively short period of time and then capture that increase in value in a subsequent transaction. For most of the private equity industry's life, that had been done by firms that were on the margins of Wall Street, firms that we now know as KKR or Blackstone, Thomas Lee, Texas Pacific Group, other firms like that. These were founded by former bankers, had a tremendous amount of financial knowledge that they brought to the transactions they were structuring. What was new beginning in the 90s across Wall Street was the interest on the part of Wall Street from becoming not just the people who helped these outsiders finance their transactions, but on becoming partners in the transactions themselves. Merrill made a big push into this arena, as did Goldman Sachs and a number of other large Wall Street firms. They wanted to be partners with their clients and not just record fees, but put their own capital on the line and become investors in their own right. Ultimately, they saw their role increasingly as being their own best customers.
They found a way into private equity funds, buyout funds, and hedge funds. Of course, a lot has been said about hedge funds, but just give our listeners a brief description of what hedge funds do versus, for example, what a mutual fund does or can't
well,
do?
A mutual fund is essentially a pool of investors' capital where the manager who is hired by the firm that oversees the fund will invest that pool of capital according to a set of guidelines. So you can invest in a U.S. large cap growth fund, and the manager will go and buy and own the large cap growth stocks he or she believes have the best long-term return prospects. A hedge fund has no limitations, essentially. In practice, most of them will define themselves or describe themselves according to a certain set of criteria. So you'll have long-short hedge funds or event-driven hedge funds. So they'll have a certain broad set of criteria. But what really separates them from a mutual fund is that while they're still a pool of capital, they're a relatively unregulated pool of capital where only a defined number of investors can put their money in, where investment minimums are very high, and where what the manager does faces very few limitations. Their access to a hedge fund is limited to people that are thought of as being accredited investors, sophisticated, quote-unquote, investors with large amounts of capital at their disposal.
Right.
A hedge fund, in practice, it carries higher fees, and the manager can pretty much have total discretion over how those funds are deployed, subject to the consent upfront of his investors. So someone raising funds for a hedge fund will say, I'm going to use this model. I'm going to try and add alpha. In other words, I'm going to try and use my superior knowledge of the markets to generate returns above and beyond those that the market itself in the shape of an index offers. And I might go and own gold, or I might short hedge funds. I might go invest in Vietnamese stocks. I might do all of those things together, which a mutual fund manager would never do. And I'm going to be trading very actively around the fringes.
Right. In fact, the fact that the hedge funds and the private equity funds and the buyout funds were poaching talent from Wall Street's investment banks might have even led Goldman Sachs to go in that direction. Is that right?
It was certainly one of the factors. People began describing hedge funds as more of a compensation model than a really radically different business model. A typical hedge fund manager or team of managers could earn, well, a typical pattern might be something like a 2% management fee and then 20% or even more of any profits that they earned. Now, if you compare that to a mutual fund gets, you know, a fraction of a percent of the assets under management each year as a management fee. The managers don't get a share of the profits. You know, it's much more like being, you know, a salaried middle management worker in any American industry, whereas running a successful hedge fund is a ticket to instant riches if you do it well, because then everybody wants to invest in with you, and you can pretty much make out like a bandit just on the strength of the management fees.
Most folks would probably give a left ear to be accepted into Goldman Sachs, but a fellow by the name of Kevin Conway, tell our listeners about what happened with him.
Well, Conway was offered partnership and said, no, this isn't for me. And he was one of those very rare individuals who just said, no thanks, I think I'll go off and do something different. In fact, he ended up joining a private equity firm rather than a hedge fund. But by the late 1990s, a lot of Goldman Sachs alumni were deciding to, rather than just retire and go into politics or something like that, they retired earlier and went and set up their own hedge funds. It was certainly far more lucrative if you went and did that. If you were a good trader or a great investor, this was the way to make money. It certainly wasn't by going off and running a mutual fund. If you were good at what you did in either the trading or the investing space, you wanted to be running a hedge fund. That was the way to parlay your prowess into riches.
Hedge funds had some of their best years when they really took off, as you said in the book, during the 2000 to 2002 bear market. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's right. In that bear market, which unlike the 2007 to 2009 crisis period, everything went down in tandem, albeit at slightly different rates and different times. In the 2000 to 2002 period, in contrast to the market crisis that we've just been through, hedge fund managers, because of their go-anywhere approach, could really look around at the market and say, okay, we definitely don't want to be in these dot-com stocks, so we can short those. We can go long value stocks, which we think are going to outperform. And we can head off in other areas in parts of the market that are less susceptible to the downturn. So while the hedge funds that everybody had been concentrating their assets in, the growth funds, took a real nosedive along with the NASDAQ index, from which the latter at least has never recovered, hedge funds sailed merrily along and looked great in comparison. And that, along with their growing sophistication of investors, made more and more people more and more eager to get into them.
Now, while all this was happening, the regulators, I guess, were having a tough time figuring out how Wall Street had morphed. One of these regulators, who was a staff attorney for the SEC, a guy by the name of Gary Aguirre. Tell our listeners about what happened to Gary.
Gary Aguirre, he was an attorney who began scrutinizing the relationship between John Mack, who had succeeded Phil Purcell at the helm of Morgan Stanley, and one of Morgan Stanley's biggest clients, a hedge fund. And he became concerned by what he saw as a pattern that indicated or that served as a kind of warning signal of insider trading, that Mack's hedge fund buddies essentially were, Aguirre thought, tipping Mack off to transactions and allowing him and or Morgan Stanley traders to get in ahead of the game. And he took his concerns to his superiors, who said initially, go with it, you know, investigate it, see where this leads. But then when he wanted to depose John Mack, i.e. take his testimony, the boom came down. And all of a sudden, Aguirre, who had been getting recommendations and audits for his work as a staff attorney, was told, no, you cannot do this. And he was ultimately forced out of the SEC for essentially trying to do his job. He was another one of these unsung heroes who, unappreciated at the time heroes, who was looking out for cases where lines were being crossed in the pursuit of profit on the part of Wall Street institutions. Nothing has occurred since then that would prove that Morgan Stanley, John Mack, or the hedge fund manager in the case were doing anything wrong. But I think what is more significant is that the person who was concerned about the pattern that he saw was blocked from pursuing it and ultimately pushed out of the SEC. And indeed, he settled his own lawsuit against the SEC earlier this year and received his salary for the years that had elapsed since he was forced out of the agency.
But that sent a stern signal to other regulators, didn't it?
There's this pattern called a chill effect. And in journalistic circles, we refer to it as libel chill. If you're going to write about somebody that you know sues almost at the drop of a hat, you're extremely careful about what you say, and you might not say everything that you think you can prove, or your editor may veto something. In regulatory circles, it was, gosh, maybe there are some people who are just too powerful and who are off limits for us to pursue. Even if we think we have a case and could prove it in a court, we're not going to be given the opportunity to do so, was the message. Whether that was intended or not, that was the takeaway on the part of a lot of regulators.
Fast forwarding to this recent crisis, the collapse of the mortgage market, you say on page 133 that Wall Street was drunk on cheap money and oblivious to the inevitable hangover. Now, explain a little bit in closing how the low interest rates and the leverage seemed like the largest nail in the coffin of Wall Street when it came to this housing boom and bust.
To have a collapse take place requires a lot of things coming together. And while in my book, as we've been discussing, many of the root causes, the groundwork was laid decades or years earlier, that wouldn't have been as dangerous or as toxic had there not been these proximate causes or trigger events or things that enabled or encouraged or made it possible for people to behave foolishly. So the instinct to behave foolishly or the rewards for behaving stupidly were in place for a long time. When interest rates hit rock bottom levels at the beginning of the last decade in the wake of the 2002 market collapse and recession and stayed there for many years, that was an outright incentive for people to throw caution to the wind. Now they could make more loans to people. They could encourage homeowners to refinance or to take out mortgages with absurd terms that they probably should have known full well were absurd in terms of structure, just because they could then package those up and resell them to a greater fool down the chain. The ability to do so was all that mattered. No one stopped to say, wait a second, is this what we should be doing? It was what they could do, and therefore that alone became the rationale for doing it.
And after all the dust settles with the new legislation coming down the pike, as you explain in your fine book, Obama's Paul Volcker rule, you say it's going to take perhaps 5 or 10 years for the impact of this latest disaster to really take shape and for the legislation to really point the way to a much safer Wall Street. Isn't that right?
even then, I'm skeptical because, as Glass-Steagall showed us, you can set up rules that stop Wall Street from doing what it wants to do to make money. You can say, no, you can't do this. You can put up a wall, but it's just like putting up any other wall. If someone really wants to be on the other side of it, they're going to find a way to get there. They're going to go around it. They're going to dig a tunnel underneath it. They're going to chip a hole through it, and if necessary, they're going to build a hot air balloon and sail over the top of it. It may take years for them to do so, but if there's a regulation that they feel is preventing them from making the kinds of profits they feel they need to be making and should be making, that their investors are demanding from them, they're going to find a way around that, or ultimately a way to demolish that wall. It remains to be seen whether the Volcker Rule is another Glass-Steagall that is ultimately doomed to extinction. My suspicion at this point is that it is, that it's not going to change the way that those on Wall Street think about their businesses. It's not going to change what John Mack said is really the DNA of Wall Street. He stood up in a discussion about a year ago now at the end of 2009 and said, look, I have no problem with regulators trying to rein us in because the fact is we can't control ourselves. Now, his motivation for admitting that was probably political in nature. Certainly, he didn't seem to feel that that was such a bad thing a few years earlier when he was running with the rest of the crowd and taking silly risks. But he was admitting the truth of the matter, that left to their own devices, Wall Streeters these days are really programmed to maximize profits and that they're not programmed to stop and think about the consequences of their actions on the system of which they're an integral part, and a system, moreover, that relies on them being healthy and well-managed institutions. And I think that is the essence of the problem, and that is why the subtitle of this book is as gloomy, perhaps, as it is. With the Volcker Rule, yes, we stopped financial institutions for now from putting their own capital at risk in ways that might prove destructive. But no law, however well conceived, well thought out, well policed, no regulation can change the way the bankers themselves think about their business and the nature of that business. If the ethos is still one of chasing Goldman Sachs, then whether it's Goldman Sachs next time or Bank of America Merrill Lynch or some firm that today is small and isn't the one that's thought of as a firm to chase, you know, we're not going to change that model. We're going to still remain chasing whoever the leader is.
Suzanne McGee, terrific book. I want to thank you so much for the time you spent with me today. Where's the best place for somebody to pick this book up?
It's stocked at most bookstores. Most large bookstores, you can find it. You can also easily pick it up at an online retailer like Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Suzanne, thanks again so much for your time.
Thank you for your interest.